This is Grieving Out Loud. I'm your host, Angela Kenneke, and today we have a special guest. Dr. Hannah Statz DeVries is a psychiatrist specializing in addiction care. She's also a valued member of our Emily's Hope Board of Directors. And today, she's sharing all of her knowledge about substance use disorder with us.
It's just challenging because there's so much stigma around it. There's so much choice that people find ingrained into it, like family members saying, "This is a decision. Why can't you stop? You just had 28 days of treatment. What was it even worth?" And that's so hard when patients don't have that support, because it takes more than 28 days for that healing to happen.
Not only will Dr. Statz DeVries share eye-opening issues she encounters in her practice, but she'll also shed light on essential topics that family members of those battling substance use disorder should be aware of. But that's not all. We'll discuss some of the most controversial topics surrounding our nation's drug epidemic and addiction.
I won't get started with the legalization also of marijuana, but I have my concerns.
You have your concerns about marijuana. So the debate is out there. Is marijuana addictive?
We have a cannabis use disorder, you know, that we have well documented. So, you know, and there's also intoxication and withdrawal syndrome. So my answer is yeah.
Get ready for a thought-provoking conversation everyone should hear, especially as our country faces its deadliest drug epidemic in its history.
Hannah, welcome to Grieving Out Loud. I'm so appreciative that you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I'm also super excited that you joined the Emily's Hope Board.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Absolutely. It's an honor.
Yeah. We are so excited to have you. You have such a great background in addiction medicine. And I want to just dig right into that and talk about your background, why you decided to go into this field of medicine, and what you're learning along the way. You're relatively new in the field, right?
Yes, I am. I did my psychiatry residency in Chicago and followed that with a fellowship there for addiction psychiatry through Northwestern Memorial Hospital, and through mentorship that just kind of seemed to be what fit in my residency training. For some reason, I gravitated toward patients who were suffering from addiction. And I think I can probably trace that back to college, maybe even high school, honestly, from like a nutrition and obesity standpoint, actually, and kind of the compulsory behaviors people will have with obesity.
Talking about like food addiction.
Like food addiction. And Nora Volkow, actually the director of NIDA, talks about that too. And so, yeah, I found it there and I gravitated toward these patients and learned a lot. And maybe selfishly feel it's very rewarding when you see people succeed and when you feel like you've done something and can help and you see them in sobriety and just really doing so well.
I would think, though, it's also a difficult field to be because, first of all, there's so much stigma around addiction and so much misunderstanding about what it really is, what causes it.
Absolutely. I will say that my husband says this, like, addiction, like you chose addiction. This is so hard. And, you know, he works in the ER and
also a doctor, your husband.
Also a physician. And he sees addiction at, you know, when people are at their worst, withdrawing from anything and maybe not wanting help at that point. And he'll ask me, how do you do this day in and day out? And I think largely where I'm at, you know, in an outpatient setting, also residential, so a little bit more acute there, I'm seeing people when they say, hey, I need help. And it's time. And sometimes it's family finally feeling like they were able to effectively reach that person, you know, when you struggle so much, because we see it, right? We can see it from the outside, but when that person isn't ready for it, it's hard to reach them.
So you're saying the area of addiction you're working in, you're working with the patients once they decide they do need help, which, I mean, before that, it can be just so grueling and such an awful experience for everyone involved, the family, friends, the patient themselves.
Excruciating. And I think the difficult part about that, and that's the crux of treating addictions, you know, you look at motivational interviewing as a cornerstone for treating patients. And as soon as I find myself telling a patient what they should be doing, gosh, they shut down. Whether it's they leave, you know, against medical advice, they don't come back for an appointment, or, you know, I hear it from family or others. And so I think finding from within where that person's at and meeting them where they're at and kind of really trying to target what are your goals, what are your values, and how can I help you reach those. And that change has to come from within, and it's hard.
You know, I did an early podcast in season one with Dr. Matt Stanley, who's a colleague of yours.
Yeah.
And we talked about how addiction is a disease of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's just so much misconception about that still to this day. The public generally doesn't believe it's a disease. They think it's either a character problem or a matter of willpower. Can you explain it in a way that people can understand how substances take over the brain?
I can. With addiction, our brain is an organ just like any other organ. And when we start drinking, consuming drugs, using whatever it might be that has a habit-forming potential, what happens is the progression is it's a biopsychosocial pattern or the route that takes. First and foremost, the drugs or alcohol start to take over your brain, your central nervous system. Everything else kind of still seems to be going okay. Psychiatrically, mentally, you know, depression hasn't really started to show or manifest, and anxiety, even insomnia. You're doing okay. Well, then that psychiatric kind of side of things, you're not sleeping as well, or you're maybe feeling anxious because you're going in and out of intoxication and withdrawal. And that drug, that pathway deep in the limbic system, really of your brain, is starting to take over. Last but not least, friends and family say, hey, Joe, or whoever it may be, what's wrong? Like, something's wrong. You're not showing up for work, you know, and that's the social piece. So the biopsychosocial. Well, the problem, or what people don't see with this disease model, is recovery occurs in the opposite direction, where socially, people start to look better. So people come to my 28-day residential treatment center, and, you know, I'll say, hey, you've been here for a couple of weeks. You look great. You look awesome. You must feel great too. And patients will look at me like, am I supposed to say yes? And really the answer is no. It can take, I mean, months, years, really, before someone's back functioning where they were before everything happened.
Years.
And that's something that we call post-acute or protracted withdrawal. So socially, people start to look better. Then kind of comes next is the psychiatric kind of side of things. Anxiety, maybe depression starts to lift. Sleep starts to normalize again. But then there's your brain. That's the biological side of things, where the drugs or the alcohol have so deeply ingrained themselves into your, really your biology, that it takes time to heal.
That's what I've heard. It takes up to 24 months for the brain to heal from drugs like meth or heroin or opioids. Mm-hmm. And we only treat people for 30 days. I often say that's dictated by insurance companies, but where did that model come from? And would it be too cost prohibitive to really treat people for like a year and a half to 2 years?
Gosh, really good questions. I'm not sure. What I can say from my experience is when patients are coming in and say it's a 28-day stay, I'll even get pushback from insurance companies at like 2 or 3 weeks sometimes and saying, hey, does this person really need to be there? And I will think, my goodness, where is this coming from? And, you know, maybe it's that they had a good day and it was documented. But again, from my experience, I would think that probably having more intensive treatment might be cost prohibitive, just given that experience. But the relapse prevention piece, that's where I think the focus really could, well, we focus on it, but can continue to be robust. And I talk to patients about that piece. Like, when you leave here, you're going to go back into a world that's not protected. You know, you don't have these supports, these, you know, this, you're waking up and doing a mindfulness or meditation and yoga in the evenings alongside like your peers that are all in recovery. You're going to go back to reality at some point. And how are you going to work with those triggers? Because, you know, we say people, places, things, and even just being around those people, places, things release just that tiny bit of dopamine that will put someone back into the place. And that can be the trigger.
In fact, research shows that between 40 to 60% of people with substance use disorder experience a relapse at some point. The situation is particularly alarming when it involves alcohol and opioids. Studies indicate that up to 80% of people battling alcohol addiction may experience a relapse. That number rises to 80 to 95% for those struggling with opioids within the first year after treatment. We've interviewed dozens of people who have relapsed here on Grieving Out Loud, including one man, Ed Krumpotich, who was in and out of treatment nearly 50 times.
So how do you explain relapse?
Relapse is, it's as simple as this. I'm going to use diabetes as an example. right? So diabetes is actually really simple. Diabetes is addiction. That's all diabetes is, right? It's a dopaminergic craving and then an attachment to sugar or a disposition that gives somebody that, right? Relapse is rather simple. Can you expect a diabetic's blood sugar to stay at around 90 to 120 for the rest of their life? It's naturally cyclical. The difference is that the organ that is affected is the pancreas. So the pancreas goes like this, the blood sugar goes up and down and up and down. Let's take addiction. Addiction's disease lives in the brain. So picture that pancreas now as a brain. When your waves go like this, that's like not asking somebody who's eating every day to not have a blood sugar change. The chances of somebody staying sober with that amount of change in a brain is minuscule. So relapse is just decoding those attachments as they come up and they go down. They come up and they go down. Because when the brain is the diseased organ, it is one of the hardest to detach.
Relapse is not only difficult for those who suffer substance use disorder, but also their friends, family members, even their doctors.
Does that forever frustrate you, the fact that people relapse so frequently and often multiple times?
I think it would be abnormal if it didn't frustrate me. I still will talk with patients that relapsing or even just having a lapse, that's part of the illness. I kind of will differentiate, this is probably a Hannah-ism, that is not part of recovery, it's part of the illness or the disease. Recovery is that we're working really hard. You're looking at, are you meeting with your therapist? Are we stepping you down from a 28-day residential to a 3 times per week meeting, plus the AA meetings, strong family, psychosocial support, meetings with me, ongoing medication management? It's a combination of it all.
I think one thing you could explain from a physician's perspective is we now know about the danger of fentanyl in every illicit drug out there. Yet, people continue to do illicit drugs, and some people even seek fentanyl now. How often are you hearing about something like that?
Daily.
Daily.
Yeah.
Can you explain it? Like, I know something has a chance to kill you, and pretty good chance. Can you explain how the brain is working or what is happening with that person?
So what I've seen, people not even seeking fentanyl, there's fentanyl that's getting laced into just drugs, whether it be cannabis and others. And, you know, I've seen this even in some of the recent articles that you've written, that we know that this is a problem. What the dealers and people who are on the supply side of this know is if they can get someone hooked, then that person is going to come back for more and they're going to want it from that dealer. So sometimes it's an inadvertent, hey, you know, I started using and now this is what I need. And hey, it's actually fentanyl at this point. And that dopamine release, that trigger and that disease pathway, it just takes over and it becomes, that's what people want. And that's the disease clouding their judgment because the pleasure limbic center in the middle part of their brain has fully taken over that decision making, that judgment, that frontal part of your brain.
It's hard for people who don't suffer from substance use disorder to understand.
It is.
It's so hard to understand.
And that's that recovery that can take up to 2 years to really be back to a good baseline. And
have you lost patients to fentanyl?
I'm sure I have. I don't always hear about that because they don't come back to my clinic.
Right.
So I wouldn't be surprised if that has happened.
What has been maybe the most rewarding thing? Do you have any patients that have really touched your heart or you've seen such a big difference in working in this field?
Yeah. So many come to mind. I don't even know where to start. From younger to older, I mean, patients that have over 10 years of sobriety. And also even in that, I'll say, hey, don't lose sight of what you've done. With use, if you were to go back, it'll be just like yesterday that you last used if you go back to this because your memory is so closely tied with the addiction from the past. But yeah, from younger to older patients and, you know, some still in Chicago that I'll occasionally kind of wonder about and I hope they're doing well.
What did they teach you that you needed to learn?
I'm a physician and I will tell patients how to get well, what to do. We want to fix people. That's what physicians do. And I think I learned that the more I tell, the more I kind of say, this is what we have to do in X, Y, or Z. Or if I do that too much, it doesn't work. And I have failed, you know, in that sense, whether it be that a patient doesn't show back up and I wonder, what did I do? Was it me? Or maybe it was the disease and I won't know. What I think I've learned is patience, compassion, self-compassion, grace, that it's not just my medications. My medications are powerful. and they can and should be used. And I will emphasize that till I'm blue in the face with my patients. And at the same time, we have to focus on therapy too. Maybe it's 50-50. Maybe it's 70-30. Maybe it's even 80-20 in terms of percentage for therapy and for medications. But what I do know is it's a combination of both. And that's that relapse prevention. When someone's leaving treatment, what are they doing to continue to engage in sobriety and recovery?
Let's talk about medically assisted treatment, because we know there isn't enough of it and it's not for enough addictions, right? So you have Suboxone for opioid addiction and you utilize that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think Suboxone is a great treatment. I have a lot of patients that are on it, and I did a lot of this also in Chicago. Patients have to be ready for it. There's challenges with prescribing it and challenges in managing it, and a lot of education is kind of one of the things that I will kind of go back to with patients, with colleagues, to try to kind of get this out there. And by far and at large, I'll oftentimes find myself having to explain to patients, Suboxone is an opioid. And I'll bring this up to a patient and say, hey, what about Suboxone? Every so often I'll get a, I don't want that one. And I'll say, okay, let's take a step back. Why that reaction? What's your concern with the Suboxone? And oftentimes it's, well, I've tried it before. I had that and gosh, it made me sick, or it didn't work. It did nothing for me. And oftentimes what happens in that case is someone has gotten it from a friend. They've taken it incorrectly. They've precipitated their own withdrawal. And it's very uncomfortable when that happens. And so I'll go back to step one and say, this is an opioid. When you're ready, let's do it. I don't want you to white knuckle this on your own. That's not fair to you. And so I do a lot and a lot and a lot of education. I put it in their hands. I say, when you're ready, you let me know. And I have had people come back and say, hey, I think I'm ready. It happened yesterday. Someone wanted to stop it. They were just on a very low dose. They stopped it. And then they said, I don't feel good. I don't think I'm ready. I was like, I'm glad you came to that.
Can you explain how Suboxone works?
Yeah. Suboxone's a partial opioid agonist. So we're looking at full agonist opioids. That's things like Norco, the hydrocodones, morphine, fentanyl. Those at 100% will stimulate your opioid receptor. So I'm thinking the kind of analogy I'll use is a pedal to the metal, you know, in a car. And Suboxone or buprenorphine is a partial opioid agonist. So it's an agonist working at your opioid receptor, but it's more like instead of at 100 miles per hour, you're like 70 or 80 miles per hour. So you're stimulating that receptor so that you're not going into withdrawal from an opioid withdrawal management. And where it can get you into trouble is if you have a full agonist on board and I give you Suboxone, it's going to knock that full agonist off because it binds so strongly at the receptor. And it's going to put you into some withdrawal because it puts you from 100 to 70 or 80.
Does it give you a high?
There are ways to misuse, abuse medications.
So only by misusing or abusing it.
Right. What done under the prescription, you're good.
So what about the argument of treating drug addiction with another drug? I mean, that's one of the things that you've been hearing over and over again since this medication came out.
It's a treatment that we have. We see people succeed. I see people that get jobs. They get their life back. They go on to be able to do the things that they once loved. It's what are you replacing? You're replacing an opioid. And some people can't get past that kind of picture of, gosh, I'm just replacing one with the other. And where I kind of try to counsel patients is, hey, we're providing you something that we know what it is. We're helping you. We're getting you through treatment. We're getting you to some sobriety. And in the future, should you want to try to taper off of this, we can give it a try. I just ask that you're honest with me if you're struggling with it.
How many people need to be on it? Like forever. Can you be on it forever?
You know, you can. I've been in practice for less than a year, so I haven't had as, you know, robust of an experience
yet.
With it.
Yeah.
What I will say is I have seen people come off it and relapse. Year of sobriety, and they're like, hey, I want to stop. I'll say, if you're ready and you want to do this, just please work with me, talk with me, let me know how this goes. And then I've had patients stop it that actually did it on their own, kept continuing to see me, and they said, hey, I'm down to a milligram. I'm like, wait, what? And they just didn't want to be on it because they saw it as a crutch. And so close follow-up and, you know, making sure they've got those other supports can be helpful too.
You know, we don't see drugs for diabetes or heart disease in this way. We don't tell people with diabetes or heart disease to get off their medication or stop taking it because they shouldn't be doing that. You know, is this the same thing? If this is a disease of the brain and you have Suboxone to treat it, isn't it the same thing as having a drug for diabetes or a drug for heart disease or any other medical condition?
I use that example all the time. And I think patients are used to hearing it, or not all the time, but sometimes used to hearing that where, hey, if you had diabetes, I would not withhold your insulin from you. That's against any physician's practice. You know, first, do no harm. So it's just challenging because there's so much stigma around it. There's so much choice that people find ingrained into it, like family members saying, this is a decision. Why can't you stop? You just had 28 days of treatment. What was it even worth? And that's so hard when patients don't have that support, because it takes more than 28 days for that healing to happen. Just like when you break an arm, it takes more than a few weeks. Gosh, what was the break? Was it a simple fracture? Was it a compound fracture? It could take months. Brain's no different. Your brain's a much more powerful organ. It takes time.
Well, we always think it's about our thoughts or our will, right?
It just comes back to that, because I think it's just a natural,
an
human,
old-fashioned way of thinking of things.
I think so.
A dated way of thinking of things. So also with Suboxone, Congress recently made it possible for more providers to prescribe it to their patients. I don't know how many medical doctors are stepping up to prescribe it. There's still some stigma around medical doctors.
Right. And when providers aren't used to seeing patients with addictions day in and day out, there's some discomfort there.
But should there be?
No, is my answer to
that. Why is there discomfort there?
You know, it's control, right? And we've got this big opioid epidemic that our country is trying dearly to recover from. And I think it's a scary thing. If you're not familiar with it, it's probably the best perception I could have, maybe trying to look from the outside in. I will tell you, when I have conversations with physicians, I'll say, prescribe this. This is helpful. It's not harmful. If anything, you're saving their life. Because when they go back out and use whatever it is they're using, that will kill them.
Until recently, doctors who wanted to prescribe buprenorphine, an opioid medication used to treat opioid use disorder, had to complete an 8 to 24 hour training and keep special records. The Drug Enforcement Administration also assigned those clinicians a registration number, starting with an X, which many doctors claim made them a target for drug enforcement audits. But thanks to new legislation, any doctor can now prescribe buprenorphine as long as they have a DEA number. Still, Dr. Stats DeVries says there's a lot more work that needs to be done to help doctors better understand substance use disorder. Have you lost a loved one to overdose or fentanyl poisoning? I'd like to invite you to share their story on our new Emily's Hope Memorial website called More Than Just a Number. They were our children, siblings, cousins, husbands, wives, aunts, uncles, and friends. So much more than just a number. You can submit a memorial today on morethanjustanumber.org.
I think there are so many directions we can come from: training, education, even from a trainee standpoint. You know, years and years back, we've got a lot of, you know, even older physicians that didn't get very robust training really at all. You know, they're learning this in practice. Things that, you know, I'm personally trying to implement is coming, you know, this next academic year, internal medicine residents are going to be rotating with me, that I can teach them, hey, Suboxone, this is how we do it, and this is why we do it. And I think starting small steps like that can be helpful. More physicians trained in addictions, more fellowships, you know, things like that. That's an ideal world, right? I would say if I could redo my year in training, it might sound crazy, I would, but it was just the best.
I wish also we had more screening for patients at every touch point among medical systems for addiction or for drug use, for substance use. I think that just like we screen for abuse now, I think most health systems do that kind of thing. I know there's one more thing you have to screen for and one more thing the nurse might have to do when the patient comes in. But even in my daughter's case, you know, we knew something was wrong with her. And I took her to counselor after counselor. And then she was picking at her face, picking at her face. So she told me it was anxiety. And that is more than anxiety, right? I said, okay, well, let's go to a dermatologist. Let's go figure this out. And I took her to a dermatologist. The dermatologist never once asked if she was using, never sent me, she could have sent me out of the room. I mean, she was an adult at this point, could have sent me out of the room. Never once asked a question if she was using substances, prescribed a cream and an anti-anxiety medication. And so I think that tells me either that doctor had no clue. I mean, I always think of meth when I think of people and their skin, My daughter wasn't using meth, but I later learned that when people are coming down off of heroin, they pick at their face. And I didn't know that. You know, that was something in all my research and everything I can research as a journalist, I didn't know that. And I wish I would have known it, but I wish the doctor would have asked those questions. And I think about when my daughter went into like acute care type, you know, the open clinic when needed something where she had a headache and she was basically shamed by a nurse and a doctor and was sent home and told, oh, you just have to deal with your headaches. You know, obviously they probably could tell that she was using drugs, but they didn't do anything to help her. And that really concerns me. That I know that happens to more people than just my daughter.
Well, and what a disservice. You know, you think in your mind, like, here is suffering. I'm showing you suffering. Yes. What is it? Help.
Addiction is suffering.
Yeah. And as an addiction practitioner, when I see someone itching or picking or this or that, I think, hey, I need to get a urine drug screen. But I'm trained to do that. I did it day in and day out, you know, through not only my psychiatric residency, but I do it in my addiction practice. And it's hard because you're looking at someone and saying, hey, I'm going to call you out and say, hey, I'm concerned about drugs. And are you going to offend that person? But really, you're helping that person. And so where I address that with patients is I'll say, hey, part of my practice is we're going to do urine drug screens and we're going to do breathalyzers and it's going to be random. And I want you to see that as accountability and support. So if physicians, say in the dermatology or other settings, can say, hey, this is what we do, you know, when we see these concerns for accountability and support, I'm not saying that this is what you're doing. And this is just one thought, one idea that could be done to maybe address that, to then start that conversation. Because given a questionnaire, you just write no down the line. Yes. You know how it goes.
Yeah, people won't always be honest. That's true. But I often thought just the fact that my daughter was willing to go to the doctor and she hated how her face was looking, you know, what she was picking at. She hated that. And that might have been the point where if someone would have addressed it outright and confronted her with it, we should have admitted it and gotten help. You just don't know.
You don't know.
But instead, it was just like, here's a cream, here's another anti. And she'd gone to a psychiatrist before that who prescribed Klonopin. So it was just kind of a messy path.
Yeah.
There wasn't any clear direction. And I hear from so many parents and other people who have a loved one suffering from substance use disorder, and they don't know what to do. And that's the hard thing is I don't know what to tell them to do, because I tried to do all the things I could for my daughter and reached out to so many different people in the medical profession, and none of it helped. So it's a tough thing to tell a loved one, what can you do?
I find families are incredibly important. When I see my patients in the outpatient setting, even in the residential center, I have them sign releases of information. I request, hey, I have to talk to your family and your loved ones, because if I don't get them involved, we're going to be back at square one potentially when you go. And I know you want to do this on your own. And I know you feel you got this. I just want people to be there for you. And I want to be able to kind of incorporate other people within in your support system. The issue when we're identifying it and how do we do it? I mean, if we're not kind of getting from step A to B to C and finding, hey, this is an addiction provider I'm going to go to. How are you catching it in internal medicine or maybe the ER where they're doing urine drug screens regularly? Maybe that would be a place to start. Take your loved one there. That's done regularly. And probably one of the more common places that it's that I see it done regularly, other than in my small addiction practice and, you know, one of the addiction providers here that does regularly do that and ask for it.
Right. And that, but that could change. I mean, we could change that as a society.
We could.
Yeah, we could make it easier for people to navigate this.
And sure.
But there are no real clear steps. I think that's part of the problem I have when people reach out to me is I'm like, well, I don't have all the answers. I often say if I had all the answers, my daughter would still be alive.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, so many people are dying now.
In 2022, the nation witnessed a tragic milestone as drug-related deaths reached an all-time high. According to the latest data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the lives of nearly 110,000 Americans were lost due to drug-related causes. An equal concern is the ongoing issue of excessive alcohol consumption, which continues to claim the lives of more than 140,000 Americans every year. To put it into perspective, that means approximately 380 people lose their lives every day due to alcohol-related complications.
I even look at the legality of alcohol. You know, what's the number one substance use that we're treating across the U.S. at all of our centers?
All kinds of medical conditions.
Yeah. I won't get started with the legalization also of marijuana, but I have my concerns.
of your concerns about marijuana. So the debate is out there. Is marijuana addictive?
Well, we have a cannabis use disorder, you know, that we have well documented. So, you know, and there's also intoxication and withdrawal syndrome. So my answer is yeah.
You know, people don't like to hear that.
Yeah, no one likes to hear it because it's a panacea. It's a cure-all for everything.
That's what you
know.
I always say it's not for the developing brain. I try to stay out of it, the use for adults. But I mean, it just worries me that kids are going to have more access to it now that it's becoming legal in so many places.
Legalization to commercialization to advertising to marketing. Not to say that it may be helpful for certain people in certain instances with the evidence base for it. You know, if you give me the evidence, I'll say, absolutely, let me help you. It's not regulated. So for me, also seeing patients with addictions, it's just not in my repertoire of treatments.
But there is withdrawal. I think people need to know that.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk about withdrawal for a minute because it's a really tough thing. But I fully can understand it because I've never been through it. But I've heard it's not just a physical thing, that it's a psychological thing. And it's just almost like a break for people. When I say break, I don't mean like a good break. I mean like break internally and psychologically.
Yeah, all of the above. This is where, you know, we had kind of the opioid crisis with prescription medications, you know, as being one of the waves of the opioid problem, followed by, hey, doctors saying, we can't give this because we have a problem. And now patients are left without meds, going then to things like heroin, fentanyl. And because the withdrawal is so uncomfortable, if my doctor won't prescribe me the copious amounts of opioids that they once were, well, now I feel really crummy. What do I do? Hey, your friend over here says, I can help you. And then the next thing you know it, it's heroin. And to kind of speak to your question with the withdrawal, it's physical, it's mental. And that's that disease piece where the addiction has started to wreak havoc on your dopamine pathways and release abnormally large amounts of dopamine in your brain. And that's your pleasure center. That's your survival center. If drugs take over your survival center, it goes from wanting drugs to saying, gosh, I don't just want it. I feel like I need it and I need it to survive. What a scary thing.
Yeah, it's very scary. And I think that's a piece that's very important to point out because someone who is suffering from substance use disorder does think they need the drugs to survive.
Right.
And that's so hard. It's because we see it over and over again in society where people will, you know, they'll lose a job, they'll stop taking care of their children. And it's so hard to understand because the brain really has been hijacked.
Hijacked by dopamine. Yeah, right. That's how I actually describe it to my patients.
Right. So what do you think the future is for addiction medicine? Do you have any high hopes here? Any kind of medically assisted treatment for meth around the corner or anything like that?
I think there's a lot of research going into that. I hope that there's more that's being developed for some of the other substances. You know, we've got 3 FDA approved medications for alcohol use disorder.
It's more than we've ever had.
More than we've ever had. And then that naltrexone piece kind of being used for cravings and a lot of other addictive behaviors. We use it.
I just heard that Ozempic may help with addictions. I wonder if that's true. You probably have no opinion on that because you don't know, but I mean, I've been hearing that.
I have an unread message in my email right now on just that. So I haven't read it yet, but I've heard about it too.
Yeah, I don't know. I've always feel like there's bound to be a price to pay with a drug like that in the long run, but
I don't know.
I mean, if it would help people, who knows?
Right.
Who knows? I also think I love to see Emily's Hope scholarships go to a addiction care center that's affiliated with a medical system. And I think that's what I love to see the most is addiction care affiliated with the medical system rather than someone just hanging. Not that centers that just hang a shingle up are bad and start a center. They could have good people. They could be good. But I feel like this needs to be treated within a medical system because it is a disease of the brain.
I couldn't agree with you more. There are treatment centers all over the United States. And if someone can't go to one for one particular reason that maybe I'm recommending, say, please just go somewhere where it's a physician that's overseeing your care.
Right.
Because my understanding is that if an insurance company is going to allow insurance dollars to pay for a treatment, at that point, I can't tell you further unless I know the people that are treating you. If it's just somewhere where you're going to do groups day in and day out and not have family contact or family sessions while in treatment and reaching out that when you leave, you're not just left empty-handed.
Right, right. Well, I appreciate everything that you're doing. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining me today. I know you're so busy. You got a baby, you're a mom, and you're working and running this addiction care center and doing all these things. How do you manage it all?
You know, I've got a really supportive husband and a really supportive family, and I love what I do. And until I'm overwhelmed, at that point, I think my husband will know. And Angela, thank you for your passion for this and for your help. And I know that our residents at the Addiction Care Center and receiving your scholarships, it makes a difference. It, you know, when patients can't pay for treatment, that should not be what's limiting them. So thank you.
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, that's why we do it. We want to take away the barriers. I mean, finances can be a big barrier.
Yeah.
For people getting treatment.
They are.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Grieving Out Loud. If you found it helpful, we'd appreciate you sharing it with friends and family, as well as writing a positive review on Apple Podcasts. It helps to further our mission to raise awareness about our nation's deadly drug epidemic and decrease the stigma surrounding substance use disorder, hopefully getting more people the help they need. You can also find out more information about Emily's Hope, including how you can get involved, by checking out our website, emilyshope.charity. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, wishing you faith, hope, and courage. This podcast is produced by Casey Wannenberg-King and Anna Fye.